With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome, you wonderful Earthlings. I hope everyone is doing great and having an awesome day. Today on episode 4 of Mysteries with a History, we're going to take a look into very mysterious and bizarre cases of when officials, such as law enforcement and commercial pilot captains, have come into contact with UFOs and the bizarre. I'm not going to go into any announcements tonight, so we'll go straight into the show. So when the world of officialdom and when the world of the mysterious collide, so much happens. If anyone has any cool stories involving police officers or commercial pilots encountering the strange and mysterious, let me know in the live chat. Give me the reference and we'll look at it together. So our first story tonight is one of the most famous cases when it comes to policemen encountering a UFO, and that is the strange and intriguing Val Johnson case. Have any of you heard of that case before, or like just even vaguely? There's even a whole museum. Well, not a whole museum, but there is a piece in a certain kind of museum that has something during that encounter. Has anyone seen it? Hey, Michael, good to see you. So good to see you. Zofa, hey there. Case for Infinity. Oh my gosh, so good to see all of you. Hi, Bobby Broadway. And Creepy Little Book, awesome. I hope you guys are going to enjoy today's topic of law enforcement and UFOs. Is anyone here watching this retired or a present police officer or in some kind of field in the law enforcement that maybe you had an encounter of your own? Because if so, I want to read it out loud and to say hi to, well, not to say, I mean, I want to say hi to all of you, but to read it out loud if you're willing to share it. Ah, thank you. Did I say I'm not deranged? Oh, deranged lunatic. That's a funny name. Thank you so much. Let's dive in to our first story. So the Val Johnson case is a pretty infamous case that happened in Marshall County, Minnesota, August of 1979. You know, with all of this talk about UFOs, all of the things that I've researched, and doing all of these mysteries with a history, it seems like, and you know what, maybe I'm just crazy, but it seems like the 1960s to the 1980s was kind of some of the most documented UFO sightings that I have ever read, and also in many cases, some of the most famous. But that is just speculation. I want to hear what you have to say. When do you think is like the hot, when do you think was the hottest year of UFO sightings that were written? And if you do agree with me between the 1960s and the 1980s, why do you think that is? Why do you think there were so many sightings during that time? Like a ton. I want to know. So this Val Johnson was in 1979, the hot period. And he was a deputy sheriff who had an encounter with an extraterrestrial force during that summer, so many decades ago. It says that when he was driving at like almost 2 a.m. in the morning, because he had the night shift, he saw this really bright light just coming closer to him. And it didn't look like headlights. And it kind of seemed like it was floating 3.5 to 4 feet off the ground. He couldn't rationalize what he was seeing. And then the more he's driving very cautiously, not knowing what this object is, it accelerates and it just hits his windshield incredibly hard. Because of the impact, he passes out and wakes up about 40 so minutes later. There's a huge crash on his windshield, and he didn't really understand what was going on. If that were to happen to you, if you were a policeman in the 1970s or even today, and something crashes into you, but doesn't kill you, right? Doesn't kill you. And there's only a dent in your windshield. What would you think that would be? Maybe a bird. Okay, possibly. But what bird has really bright lights at 2 a.m? Rationally speaking, if you had to already debunk the beginning of the story before we even getting to the debunking side of what other people thought, if that were to happen to you, what would be the first thing that would come to your mind? Other than like, I for damn sure know I'm not crazy. At least, I mean, I would hope that I wasn't crazy if that were to happen to me. It's just so weird. When this happened, he lost about 40 minutes of time. He was unconscious. His car was about 800 meters from where he remembered it driving last, and the radio didn't work, which is a very common factor when it comes to almost any UFO sighting by anyone. Is a lot of the times either the cars stop working or some kinds of electronics are affected. He lost a bunch of time. His car wasn't working, but the reason to why his radio wasn't working when he tried to call in for backup was that the radio antennas like got bent. They got bent. And how could that possibly happen? It was some kind of external force. We'll get into that in a second. But also, his his car clock and his stopwatch were 14 minutes behind the real time. So not only did he lose about 40 minutes of time, but also his watch and the car clock were 14 minutes behind the time that it should have been. There are a lot of things that stand out in this story that are pretty bizarre, and that kind of in a case, I wouldn't want to say be proven, but not only do you have an eyewitness account, but you have evidence of something weird happening. Maybe not the truth of him possibly getting abducted or him really getting hit by a UFO, but the evidence of the car, the evidence of his watch losing time, being 800 feet away, are all big factors to this. When he trying to talk about it, in some cases he was taken, I wouldn't say seriously, but people wanted to believe him. And there were other eyewitness accounts that did see this weird light in the sky. So it added a little bit of validity to what he was seeing, and it didn't classify him too much as being crazy. Furthermore, when he was in the car, when he gained back his consciousness, when he looked behind him, behind the road, there was a black brake marks that had obviously been caused by his car. The weird thing was he didn't remember pressing on his brakes. How did that streak mark happen from his car if he doesn't remember? He was so confused. Again, he called the radio, but he wasn't able to because the antennas were totally bent. There were some debunking stories of the reason to why this happened was due to the high heat of this other object that smashed into him. And the speed that it happened, the antennas were able to bend. However, when that was tested in a lab, that wasn't correct. That wasn't correct. They tried it. They tried that theory, scientists. But it seemed like those antennas were pushed by a force, by an external force that wasn't due to just overheating of the car. That's weird. And it's nice that they had a theory and that they were able to debunk that theory. And it, in some cases, that just leads to more questions. When you get answers, in some cases, it just leads to more questions. And you're thinking, where can I find what I'm looking for? Where can I find the answers that I need? This bright ball of light, you know, at first, Val just thought it was his imagination, and he couldn't rationalize the situation of what really happened. Even to this day, he doesn't know. When the story broke out with this in the 1979, it was all over the news. It was all over the news. He was getting phone calls every single day. His phone wouldn't stop ringing. He was so fed up with it. His wife was going insane with all of the calls they were getting and him having to tell the exact same story over and over again. His story never changed. It stayed consistent. And he didn't add anything or take away anything from his story every single time he got asked it. It was also all over the newspaper at this time, and it did go national throughout the United States of what was going on. He was pretty excited when his story was no longer on the front headlines of every newspaper. And when he stopped getting phone calls, he seemed a lot more at peace because after a while, one, he didn't know the answers, but two, after a while of telling the exact same story every single time, it can get a little exhausting. And you're just thinking, oh, can someone ask me something else? Like, what's my favorite flavor of ice cream or something, instead of the same story over and over and over again of this weird object hitting my car, which there's no evidence of. He said it was about a foot in width. So it's a pretty small object that went incredibly fast. And he described it as being hit by a 400-pound pillow. That's a pretty interesting way to describe it. Like, why a pillow? Was it because it was somewhat soft, but also really hard? What was going through Val's mind many years later to describe this object and this kind of impact as being a 400-pound pillow? What would go through your mind if you had this encounter and you had to describe it to someone? And like, what would you describe it as? Because this was also before the time things were described as a tic-tac object, you know, a gimbal, cigar shaped. This is kind of a little bit before that. And what he said about this object was that it had very defined sides, which is also really interesting that even though this happened so quickly, he was able to get some pretty good details on what this object was, how big it kind of was, how it was a few feet off the ground. I find that kind of weird, especially after he became unconscious after. How much of that could have been his imagination, maybe due to a concussion? We don't know. We really don't know. This is an incredibly famous case, and I'm really just briefly going over it because it's been talked about, it's been heard of so often that I really just kind of want to ask more questions when I hear this story. If you could talk to Val right now, Val Johnson, if you had his phone number, if you guys were friends, what would you ask him about the case? What if you could ask anything about the case? Of course, you want to be respectful on that. If you could ask him anything.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And if he had all the answers, if he had all the answers, and if you could ask him anything, what would it be? I have so many. I couldn't leave it to just one question. I could count all of them on like both sides of my fingers, both of my hands on both of my fingers. You know what I mean? That it would be hard. It would be really hard to say what I would ask him. The car that he was driving became so famous. It went inside of a museum where it shows the windshield being smashed, the antennas being bent, some headlights being smashed as well. And people can go and see it for themselves. So it's really exciting that here in Minnesota, they're able to preserve some history on this by keeping something so important, so precious, that in a lot of UFO incidences, that doesn't really happen. You don't really have evidence like you do for this specific story. Here's something that is kind of odd about this that I didn't read on very many websites and books about this case that I want to touch base on. And that was, he had went to the dentist just prior to having this encounter. And when he went to the dentist, he got his x-ray done, right? Just to make sure that all his teeth are fine, which is what we usually do. I think it's like every few years you get x-rays when you go to the dentist. And his teeth look completely fine. Like there's nothing wrong with his nothing wrong with his teeth to be concerned about. Maybe they were like a little bit crooked here and there, but nothing bizarre. After the encounter, he goes back to the dentist for his checkup of some sort. And he gets his x-rays done again. Here's the really weird thing about those second sets of x-rays is that it looked like his gums were all broken up. Like it didn't make sense on how it looked. Let me read it to you so it makes a little bit more sense of what I'm trying to say. So when he did his follow-up procedure, the bridge work was no longer intact. Okay. What was more is that they were broken at the gums. This should have resulted in massive swelling and severe pain for Johnson. However, he suffered from neither. And that kind of goes into the conspiracy of him possibly being abducted. His bridge of the mouth was no longer intact, right? The gum was all broken up, which would cause a normal person that if that really did encounter to someone consciously, severe pain, incredible swelling. However, for him, he wasn't in pain. There was no swelling. How can you answer that? How can you answer that and say, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense? Bone loss? That's a good question, Anna. I don't know. I didn't read anything about that. But if any of you that are reading know if there's any kind of bone loss, let me know. I want to read it. Did he ever try to remember what happened? To my knowledge, and from what I read, again, no. It didn't seem like he went through any kind of hypnosis of any sort. But it seems like in almost every UFO case, there's missing time. And what happens during missing time? Well, we don't know until there's some kind of hypnosis going on. So if I could ask him anything, that would definitely be on my list of have you gotten hypnosis? And if no, you should. And I want to ask you more questions during that session. How many of you have heard that story? It's popular. It is in quite a few documentaries, and it is talked about heavily, and it's classified as being one of the most famous UFO stories. I wouldn't classify it in the top 10 most famous stories personally from what I've researched, but it is pretty high up there. This next story is about another policeman called George Wheeler, and he's actually had two encounters, but let me look at this because Sourceo citing top cop UFO story. Let me look at that. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, well, I will look at it in a bit because I lost my place. All right. So this next story by George Wheeler. He was a cop in April of 1976 in Elmwood, Wisconsin. Look, we got another account in the 1970s, another one. And I'm going to start pointing these out as these shows progress on these kinds of dates that are happening. And it's talked about, but it's not talked about enough. Like, that's insane. That's insane. I mean, what are your thoughts? I want to ask you again. What are your thoughts on that? This hot spot of time. So, George Wheeler, the 1976 in Elmwood, Wisconsin, had an incident that was also witnessed by several other residents. It was the second time in a year he had been present at such an event, and the incident took place in a small town with a population of less than 1,000. This is also somewhat common, but not incredibly touched on as well, is that when it comes to the small towns, they always get the weird stuff. They always get the really weird things that big cities do not always get, but there are also some pretty compelling stories, eyewitness accounts in the big cities as well, which makes me question, why isn't there enough coverage on these big city sightings, such as Houston, Texas, you know, such as Los Angeles, things of these kinds of places that get these UFO sightings, but they're not always as popular when you want to tell a campfire story as those locations that are little small town places. This George Wheeler story, because I'm gonna hit another one that's also incredibly famous, and made me lose my train of thought because I love this upcoming story, but I want to finish this one by George Wheeler. So he had more than one encounter. Both of them shocked him so much that he was a lot more excited to have these encounters and was looking forward to his second one. The first one, I think, was just like a regular sighting, but the second one was something a little bit more profound. So around 11 p.m. on the evening of 22nd of April in 1976, George Wheeler would spot what he believed to be an orange glow from a fire near Tuttle Hill in a small town of Elmwood, around 60 miles from the Mississippi River, and with a population of just over 700 people. That is not much. That's really small. It's like, what, the size of my family? I mean, it's not that big. Wheeler himself, for over three decades, he was a policeman. And for any of those that are policemen, you go through a lot of training. You have to have rational thinking, common sense, and you do a lot of training in these kinds, I wouldn't say like UFO sightings, but in cases of how to deal with people, how to deal with criminals, how to deal with things of injustice, things of that nature. What they don't teach you there is what you do when you encounter a UFO. They're so used to being in power, having authority, having their gun out and being like, hey, you gotta listen to the law. But how can you arrest an alien? How can you arrest a craft that is going past the speed limit? You can't. And that's why I really want to talk about this kind of topic, is it shifts the paradigm of these people in law enforcement, because they don't know what to do. They don't learn it in their training. Thank you so much, Emilio. Really appreciate you. Thank you so much. And NP, these encounter recollections. Thank you. Recollections. I said recollections, but thank you so much, NP. You're awesome. I hope you guys are liking these stories so far and kind of getting a lot more commentary than usual. I thought it would be nice to change it up today and give you more commentary, ask a lot more questions, and then just instead of just reading you stories and hopefully trying to interact a little bit more, because let me tell you, it's a little bit hard of reading and then not losing my train of thought. I wonder how often animal control was contacted for sighting of things not human. Anna, that's a good question. That's a good question. But then it would lead me to the question, how much evidence is out there, or who would leave evidence out there of creatures not of this earth? I don't know. Arrest an alien on what charges? For speeding? Have you seen how fast these crafts go? Unmeasurable speeds. They should get arrested for that. So George Wheeler, again, back in the 1970s, he saw this really strange object, just bright light in the sky. And for him, instead of being in fear, he was kind of excited. He described it as like he was looking into the sun. It was so bright. This light was so bright that it almost blinded him. It was so bright that it actually hurt his eyes. And he said, "My God, it's another one of these UFOs or spaceships." Which at the time, that's pretty good way to say it, instead of saying like an aircraft or something of a view like of Earth origin. He said after the first encounter that he had of just seeing a light that he'll be ready this time, that the next time that he sees something, he's going to be ready. And so much so that it just changed his life. It just changed his life into constantly looking up into the skies and trying to find something out there, anything to fulfill his curiosity, to help him at least find some kind of answers, or even in some cases, a little bit of joy. When it comes to humans in general, we feed off of curiosity. We love to be curious. We like to ask ourselves questions. And when we are, we like to find those answers in a lot of cases. And or we like to explore a little bit and trying to find something. Me personally, I love exploring. I love going out in the forest or the desert or wherever I am. I like to go out and just walk somewhere, not too far from civilization, because I'm not ready to have certain kinds of encounters without safety. But it's through that curiosity. It is looking for answers, trying to go UFO hunting or cryptid hunting, all this fun stuff that sparks passion, sparks a little bit of happiness, curiosity, dopamine, all of these things and all these kinds of chemicals in the brain that make you want more. For some people, when they see a UFO, it scares them a little bit and they never ever want to see it again. There are a few stories like that, one that I'll be covering a little bit later today. And it just depends on you, and it depends on the sighting that you have, because everyone's different. And if it's a pretty traumatizing sighting, then I can understand you not wanting to ever see it ever again. But if not, and if you want to see another one, like the one I did last week, with the encounter of Carl Higdon, when a UFO, an alien said, "Hey, do you want to come on my craft and go to my home planet 160,000 light years away?" He was like, "Yeah, sure, I guess." And his encounter wasn't bad at all, to the point of he didn't really pursue it any further. But it did lead to a lot of people being curious, being excited to have a similar situation happened to them. At least it inspired me. I was pretty excited that was even an option when it came to UFOs, that they could even take you to their home planet. I would have said absolutely yes, any day. I'm ready.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When George Wheeler had the second encounter, again, the light was so bright that it hurt his eyes permanently, but it also, in a case, there was possible radiation that emitted from this object and affecting Wheeler. But he kind of shrugged it off at first, you know, not really believing what happened, until later on when he went to the doctor and to realize that even though there was nothing really wrong with him, He didn't feel right. It is encounters like these that can be a little bit scary, of having certain kinds of side effects, such as radiation, such as having your eyes affected. But, and with that, doesn't make him want to have another encounter because he was ready for the second one. He's like, I had the first one. I'm excited for the second one. The second one happened. And he was like, man, I was not ready. I was not ready for this. And I wish it didn't happen. This next story, called the Alan Godfrey alien abduction case, is also an incredibly famous case in West Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. What is really weird about this case that you won't see in other cases was that he was also not only a policeman, but an investigator. He was an investigator in the 1980s, okay? Also a hot spot time period, 1980 exactly. He was investigating a case of this body that was found on top of a coal mine, like a coal mine hill. And it's really, really weird because this body by the name of Adam Ski was missing for 5 days, and he lived in a village about 30 kilometers from where the body was found. So Godfrey, the policeman, was called to investigate the case. The body was lying on its back, and it looked like it had been dressed by someone else, as the jacket had been fastened unevenly. You know, like when you pull up your jacket and then like the little teeth are kind of like this, and it's so annoying. Well, it was like that. Like, it was kind of quickly put on and messed up. The shirt was missing and the shoes had not been tied properly. It was validated that the body had not been there before 1:30 p.m. as people were working in that area. Also, there were no trails that could explain how the body got there. It was like the body had dropped from above. When this body was found, it was found about 3:45 p.m. So let me just repeat that. People that were on that coal heap, right, where the mine is and all that extra trash of the coal, they were there at 1:30, before 1:30, and there was no body there. Then 1:30 hit, and a body just appeared with no tracks leading up to the hill, and then the body's dead, right? And at 3:45 is when the investigation started. You can say, oh, I guess no one noticed the body being up there before 1:30. Possible. That is kind of possible. But think of it like this. These coal heaps are black. They are dark. If you have any kind of skin tone, you'll see it. You'll see it walking up because it stands out like a sore thumb on a black background. So that's a little bit like, I don't really believe it. But the kicker was there being no tracks of that person or people going up that heap to drop off the body in a public place. Like, why would you drop off the body in a public location where people are if you killed someone? You wouldn't. I mean, you might use the ideology, oh, hide something in plain sight. But in the daytime, in the middle of the day when people are working, I don't know. It doesn't really make sense. So there was kind of ideas that it was dropped from the sky down. Sounds a little bit like an abduction in some cases, when talking about it falling from the sky. But there's a lot more to the story. So Alan Godfrey went to investigate it, and he just found it really weird. When the body was examined by the forensic doctor, he realized that this guy, Adam Ski, had died of a heart attack 8 hours prior to when he was found, possibly from experiencing something so frightening. You know, like those cartoons where your heart stops or your hair turns white when you're incredibly scared. Kind of like that. And it really does happen. His body carried out strange burn marks and a strange substance that was found behind his neck. It was concluded that he had died before being placed on top of the coal heap. But most importantly, The analysis showed that the substance found on the back of Adamski's neck, could not be identified with something known on Earth. That's a smoking gun right there. This thing on his neck, this substance, no one knew what it was. No scientist could identify what this substance was, and it didn't look like it was from Earth. That is wild. That is wild. Several months later, after the Adamski case, Alan Godfrey would have his own UFO experience. In the early morning at 5 a.m. on the 28th of November 1980, he was on duty. He was investigating a case of a herd of missing cows. And this is common at the time. It's not really a big deal. Locals had reported the disappearance of his cattle, and it seemed to have vanished without leaving any traces on the ground. That's a bit weird. This was not a one-off incident, as the same herd of cows had disappeared and reappeared a number of times, which I guess in some cases they can run off and come back, but with no traces, no footprints of these cows leaving is kind of weird. It's the same case that Adam Godfrey was investigating, that there were no tracks when this body was on top of the coal heap. Then that same morning, went on a patrol in his little police car. He saw a bright light on the road ahead of him, just like the Val Johnson incident. When he was approached at a distance of about 15 meters and stopped, he was able to see a diamond-shaped craft hovering over in silence about 1.5 meters off the ground. The bottom part of the craft rotated anti-clockwise, and the top part looked like a row of windows. That's pretty detailed. That's pretty detailed that a lot of people aren't able to witness when they see these kinds of crafts. He was able to tell that the bottom of the craft was rotating anti-clockwise, and he was able to see windows. That is really interesting onto how close this object was, that he was able to see it and document it in his mind to record, like to come back to it and write it down. He even drew it out and explaining on how he thought it worked. But then, while looking at this craft and just being a few meters away, it zipped out. But when he looked at his watch, he couldn't account for 20 or 30 minutes. Missing time, UFO crafts, 1980, all of these things are coming together. So he couldn't account for 20 or 30 minutes of missing time. And he felt like an irritating itchiness on his left foot. Furthermore, he noticed that his left boot had been split. To give you a little context, when your boots split, or like the bottom of your shoe is split, right? It's either because they're old sometimes, but this wasn't the case for him, or when you're being dragged. When your shoes just aren't going the way that they're supposed to. You're meant to walk, you know, heel toe, but when the whole heel is all scratched up and broken, that means that something kind of weird happened. And he believes that he was actually dragged to some location that he didn't know of, that, or could even imagine where he could be. He was a little bit scared to share his experience, but when five other policemen reported seeing unusual lights that same night in the region, he felt a little more confident in sharing his story that he got abducted by aliens. How do you think, if you were in a situation that if your fellow classmates or your fellow employees didn't bring up a situation, would you have told them, or even told the public, Or would you have kept a story like this in 1980 completely to yourself and just dying with that kind of secret? I don't know what I would do. I think I would try to find the best evidence possible, going to experts if I could, trying to get things analyzed if possible. But I don't think I would go out to the public, go out to other people without having a sufficient amount of evidence to back me up, to back up my story of what could possibly happen. Instead of going in blind and being like, yep, this happened. I mean, it's only an eyewitness account. And when you're a policeman, in some cases, you kind of have this mentality because you have to write up papers when crimes happen, when you interact with certain people, you have to write about it later on. And sure, you can document what they tell you, the person that you're talking to or the criminal, but you also want to have the best evidence, talking maybe about how fast they were going in their car and that's why you stopped them, or what weapon they used to hurt someone else. You need to have this kind of evidence. So for a policeman and for myself as well, I would try my best to document it as best as possible. Thanks, John Music. Keep up the great work, Christina. Thank you so much. I hope you're awesome. Thank you. Back on to the story. So Godfrey didn't really put the two and two together of him investigating the Adamski case and his situation. It wasn't until a year later when a journalist noticed the correlation. And this impacted both Godfrey's personal and professional life. He was not taken seriously at work, and his superiors did whatever they could to make him resign. This is a pretty common factor through a lot of jobs during this time period. And I guess in some cases, maybe possibly even in present day. Now, is that fully true? I don't know. It just depends, I guess, on how you tell the story and how much evidence you have. But for Godfrey, it's hard to believe in 1980 that like you're a guy with authority, a guy with power, and you feel powerless. You got abducted by aliens and you don't know what happened, why it happened. It can make you go a little bit crazy. So his superiors wanted him to resign, to leave the field, to do something else, anything else, and to keep his mouth shut because they didn't have any answers. They didn't know what was happening. And in some cases, they just didn't believe him. They thought it was absolutely crazy. And who wants a crazy person on the job dealing with criminals? Nobody. Absolutely nobody. So after a year, he agreed to have hypnosis done to remember that period, about 30 minutes of missing time. During the hypnosis, it was revealed that Godfrey came out of his patrol car and a beam of light was shot at him from the craft. In a state of panic, he went back to the car and fell unconscious. While in a blackout state, he remembered having a floating feeling as if he was being transported somewhere. That's a pretty common factor in a lot of abduction stories. A bright light, you feel like you're floating, but a lot of it is usually very, very fuzzy. At waking up, he found himself in an examination room with a human-looking person in front of him. The person had a pleasant appearance, was about 2 meters tall, and had a beard and wore a white gown. Godfrey was asked through telepathy to lie on the examination table. Once on the bed, about 8 short beings, about 1 meter tall, with a light bulb-shaped head and large black eyes, approached the examination table. When I had talked about this last week with Encounters in the Forest, and this week and doing my own research, this is a pretty, I'm using the word common yet again, but it's a common factor. You have an examination table, you have bright lights, you have multiple creatures or entities around you in a lot of cases, missing time, the 1970s and 80s. I'm just going to keep touching on this because it's really, really important. It's really important. Godfrey never got to find out what really happened. And he could never understand what really happened. Even when the hypnosis stopped, he couldn't get all the memories because he was in a lot of stress. An important detail he did remember, though, was having his left foot examined and being wired to machines. Also, he was able to back up his testimony under hypnosis by the fact that the night of the incident when he returned, that weird things happened to this guy. That he was able to explain that his foot was really irritated during that time when he had regained consciousness, and through hypnosis, he was able to back that up, that something was being messed on with his foot. A few months later, while he and his wife were asleep, a strange sound filled the room. His wife woke up, but Godfrey seemed to be in a very, very deep sleep. The next morning, it was as if he was cured with this horrible foot pain. And not just the foot pain. This is what's kind of weird. He also became sterile because the doctors had removed one of his testicles because of this weird abduction that happened and how his body reacted. So a few months after, when they had fallen asleep, the next morning he was completely cured. Like, he was back to being fertile and like nothing ever happened. They were able to have a baby soon after. And also, doctors verified that was a miraculous cure, like almost impossible. You can't go from infertile to fertile. It's not really a thing. But in this case, due to the stress that he was caused during the alien abduction and having foot irritation and having one of his testicles to be removed due to the abduction, I guess the entities felt kind of bad. And they were like, man, let me help you out. Let me help you have a kid. Who knows? Maybe that kid is actually a hybrid. I don't know. I'm just speculating. It's just merely speculation and kind of a fun one too. We really don't know. There is not much documented on that after they had a child. It seems like it was a healthy little baby that they were able to keep. Even though a lot of abduction cases, a lot of UFO sightings have some similarities, there are some differences as well, and everyone's going to experience something somewhat different, either beautiful or terrifying. In this case, for Godfrey, it was both. It was terrifying because he couldn't remember and having like weird pain in his foot, but also amazing because he's able to have a child. And to him, the person that was doing these experiments on him on the table had a pleasant face. Like, I guess that's a plus to him. I guess that's a plus. The next story is kind of one of my favorites for this time period. And this happened on April 17th, 1966, when two policemen in Ohio stopped to investigate an abandoned vehicle along the road. Deputy Dale Spar got out of his car while Wilbur Barney remained in his. But as Deputy Spar looked behind him, he heard this really strange humming noise. So he turned around and saw a giant UFO. Could you imagine? Here's investigating an abandoned car. You're thinking, oh, this is so boring. You know, I'd rather be at home or watching TV. And then you turn around and you see a giant UFO. What a highlight to the job. What a highlight. So Siege, the co-founder of the Center for the Unexplained Events, he said he was really excited about this. He was like, oh my gosh, another story. I'm really looking forward to it. Then this giant UFO starts moving and the deputies are like, let's go chase it. So they go on a car chase. They go on a car chase for 86 miles, going about 100 miles per hour, trying to chase this giant UFO. This is one of my favorite stories, just because in some cases, it's kind of rational to to chase something you don't know. It's in policemen's blood. If something's going too fast, if they see something too weird, they'll have their lights on and they're going to go for it. They're going to go all out for it. So they chase this craft for 86 miles. They went really, really far across Ohio. The reason to why they had to, so they didn't really catch up with it, obviously. Obviously, they didn't really catch up with it. But one of the deputies kind of describes it as playing cat and mouse because this craft had some kind of intelligence to it where it would slow down when there was traffic in front of these policemen. It would speed up when it was an empty road. It knew it was being chased by these deputy cars. And I can bet money that whoever is driving that craft or flying that craft is just laughing. It's like, man, these cars are never going to catch up with me. They're still using fossil fuels. Psst. Man, I'm using this really fancy equipment, probably anti-gravity. It's like I'm playing with little kids. So that's one of my favorite stories. And the reason to why they had to stop their goose chase was because the car was fuming. The tires were being run down. There was no longer any traction on these tires. It was just like flat. And we know when we drive, you never want to have old tires. It's so dangerous when you brake. It's dangerous when it's raining, when there's ice, when there's mud, all of these things. You got to have really good tires when you're driving because otherwise it's a safety hazard. So these cops realized that this car cannot handle another 86 miles going 100 miles per hour. We better just stop our chase and let this craft go free. We might as well just catch him next time and put him in jail for speeding. Like, what would you do? So let's say you actually catch this craft. Let's just say it lands, okay? And somehow you catch it. First of all, how are you going to catch this craft? Second of all, if you do catch it, what are you going to do with it? What if there's actually no alien in there and it's just controlled by AI? Or what if there was an alien in there? Are you going to put him in jail? Are you going to interrogate him? And then what? Like, it's like they were so excited to catch this thing, but I don't think that their mentality, like, they didn't question further on what if they really did catch these things. And I love it. I love this story. Many years later, one of the deputies did talk out about it, and he said, if I could change anything in my life, absolutely anything, the only thing I regret is chasing that damn craft. Because they got ridicule for it. They got ridicule for it because Project Blue Book got their hands on this story. And they made them look like fools. They said, oh, you were chasing Venus. I didn't know Venus could move so fast like that. No, first Project Blue Book said, you're chasing a damn satellite. And they said, but then that satellite turned into Venus. I don't even have words to understand how you can chase a planet. That would be awesome. First off, if you had the proper technology, or chasing a satellite so close to the ground, so close to the ground where they're able to see the lights and it changing speeds. Yeah, it is absolutely hilarious. It is absolutely a hilarious story. I mean, so far I know, right? Venus? Imagine. Venus is very deceptive. It's in a lot of debunking stories of like, oh, you saw a crap? No, it was Venus. The brightest star up in the sky. It was Venus. And I'm thinking, I mean, how many people can actually, one, mistake a craft for Venus? And two, how many people can believe what they saw as Venus? Just the debunking stories are just, we're not that good at the time. I guess, I mean, I don't really think so. I find it a little disappointing. But Venus is a really interesting planet. Wow, that Venus is a real trickster. Let me tell you what, April. It sure is. A real troll, if you ask me. Who needs satellites when you have Venus? That one is by far one of my favorite stories. But I want to know, what's some of your favorite stories when it comes to law enforcement and UFOs? Or were there any that I covered that you enjoyed the most? I want to know, because there are quite a few out there. And we don't have time to cover any pilot stories of pilots seeing UFOs, but there are quite a few out there. One of them, an article was just written by The Debrief by Jazz Shaw. So jump over to The Debrief and read his latest article about what really happened to the Japan Airlines flight 1628 in 1986. What really happened? Just a little summary of that article. In Japan, these pilots saw a UFO while flying. However, only one really talked about it, while the other two did not back up their captain when they did see a UFO flying with them while in the air. If you want to read the whole article, again, go over to The Debrief and read Jazz Shaw's latest article on that story. Let me tell you, there are so many UFO stories out there. And I'm definitely looking forward to telling you guys so much more, hitting different kinds of topics and making sure that this show of Mysteries with a History, if it's not about UFOs and it is about the paranormal, I will somehow try to incorporate UFOs into it, because they kind of go hand in hand in a lot of cases. I really want to thank all of my Patreon supporters for helping me get this mic and this arm to give you the best audio quality for all of my upcoming shows. And if you want to support me and this channel, I have links below along with a 3-month free access to Amazon Music, completely free. I'm serious, guys. I'll just click on it and you can cancel it anytime, but it really supports my channel by just signing up to free music. I mean, that's awesome. But if you want to be extra nice and be a Patreon supporter, thank you in advance for everything that you guys do, for watching this, for commenting, for liking the video, for subscribing and hitting the bell. You're making this channel come to life. And I have so much more planned that I look forward to sharing with absolutely all of you. I want you all to remember that even though this is Mysteries with a History, to always keep your eyes on the skies.